have a military map tube with topo maps. You have a GPS unit and a radio on your belt. You have cuffs, pepper spray, and a baton. You carry a .40 caliber sidearm in a holster at your hip. It has a clip loaded with hollow point rounds. You shoot a guy to kill him, not to hurt him. That's the mantra. You carry extra clips. The explorers are nice. You go out there four-wheeling in an SUV that has been retrofitted by felons in a Texas prison. Ain't that rich? The only thing you think would be richer would be if illegals in some Ford plant in Ohio fitted out your rig. The explorer has a cage behind the back seat and a mounted radio down between the front seats and a shotgun rack behind your seat, but separated from the wets by heavy mesh. An upright pump is usually clipped into the rack. They designed the truck without asking you. For a while there, they put radios in the trucks with the mic on the opposite side from the driver. You had to lean over the whole unit and feel around on the passenger side. And some genius has designed the shotgun rack to go on the far side of the back seat over by the door, so by the time you've bent back and struggled with it, the bad guy has busted caps in you. As it is, the mic on the radio is now exactly level with your right knee. So if you're not careful, you'll lean into it and punch the button and either jam the entire channel or transmit your own singing, farting, talking to yourself. The trucks weigh 10,000 pounds, so even in four-wheel drive, you can hit a sand pit and sink. You come out of that little crisis covered in dust like flour, looking like a ghost, and the assholes back at the station just about fall down laughing. If they'd just let the beat cops run the asylum, you think, a lot of things would change. The trucks have two standard features that everyone finds indispensable, a killer AC unit and a strong FM radio. With ground temperatures soaring to 130 on sunny days and on certain nights dropping only as low as 98, the air conditioner is a lifesaver, literally. You can cool down a burning body right quick with the AC blasting. And with AC and a water jug, you can keep an illegal alive until the Borstar, Border Patrol Search, Trauma, and Rescue, lifesavers, swoop in with their helicopters. They're the Border Patrol's air cav. Cute red t-shirts. You save the wets and the boys in red fly in, get all the glory. You crap behind a bush, trying to keep it off your shoes, but Borstar goes on ABC Nightly News. As for the FM, driving 150 miles at 30 miles an hour alone, scanning the ground for sign, is boring. Even the night runs, once your proby nerves wear off, are boring. Old boys try to liven them up for you. When you're new, they tell you the Chupacabras is out there on Vidrios Drag and he sucks blood from lone wanderers. Or Bigfoot's been seen coming out of the Tinajas Altas Pass. Or there are ghosts of dead walkers creeping around the Camino del Diablo. Sometimes the bastards will even sneak up on you and shout right around 3 a.m. when you're sleepy. But that's a good way to get shot, so most of them don't bother. The FM keeps morale elevated. Radio calls to base often have a classic rock soundtrack. Van Halen and Led Zeppelin bleed through the call-ins. Sometimes newbies will be blasting the radio so loud they can't hear calls from dispatch. 10 base 10. I'm 20'd at the Pinacate lava flow. I'm going to give you every inch of my love. Over. One non-standard lifesaver fits into the space between the base radio and the passenger seat, a roll of toilet paper. It beats a handful of cactus. You grab a coffee at Circle K, microwave a burrito, then cross I-8 on the old bridge and head south on 25E. To the west, 29E parallels you. It is the actual terminus of the Devil's Highway. The twin E's take you to the Mexican border, crossing miles of a sere and mysterious bombing range. Your ironist's eye loves to pick out crazy things. Right near the Devil's Highway itself is a mutated saguaro that rises 10 feet into the sky. Its main body is thick, and the top is a scarred, messed-up ball of tissue. It looks, for all the world, like an arm raising a fist, and wouldn't you know it, the ears, or branches that stick out, form an index finger and a little finger. The Devil's Highway throws up a heavy metal devil sign to announce itself. The only thing missing is Ozzy Osbourne. The aforementioned army tanks molder in the eastern end of the basin when no one is around, and no one is ever around. You can shoot at them for fun. On the west end, under Raven's Butte, there's an abandoned squadron of jet fighters. Rounds penetrate their skin easily. You can't hardly even chip the paint off the tanks, though. Sometimes jet jockeys target the Border Patrol trucks and dog them from on high, vectoring in on their white roofs. Many of the Welton guys enjoy flipping them the bird out the window, or even jumping from the truck in the middle of the foe's strafing run and raising the finger at the startled pilots. Marine patrols training on the dirt roads interdict the sign cutters. It's pure bullshit. Pulling an agent over at gunpoint and demanding papers? This is supposed to be America. And how dumb do the jarheads have to be to pull over a federal agent in uniform in a clearly marked patrol car? The sign announcing the advent of the Devil's Highway has been liberally punctuated by 50 caliber machine gun rounds. Those bored jarheads again. If you're out early, you'll see snakes on the road soaking up some heat. Sidewinders are fun to harass. You can pull up next to them and pour water on their heads. They have fits, but don't know who to bite. It's a riot. There are other games the Border Patrol guys play. Sometimes they toss a recently shot rattlesnake, dead but still writhing and rattling, into the cage with the captured wets. That's a funny sight, watching them go apeshit in the back of the truck. And they get it, right? Old Jose has a good sense of humor about it. He pissed his pants and screamed at first, but then he laughed and called the agent pinche migra, and swear to God, he peeled that snake right there and ate it. An agent out of Welton once pulled a classic practical joke on his load of clients out near 25E. One of his boys had been taking pot shots in the desert, and he'd plugged a jackrabbit. "Hey," the agent told him, "I got an idea." He took the big jack and tucked it into some bushes near the road. Later in the day, he had some Mexicans in the back, and he was tooling along, taking them back to the station holding pens. Suddenly, he stopped the car and said, "Muchachos, un conejo, a rabbit." They crowded the front of the cage and said, "¿Dónde?" "Allí, allí, mira, es grande." They squinted and frowned, but nobody saw no stinking rabbit. "Right there, man," the agent cried. A vast plain of saguaro and dry brush and ironwood stumps. "I'm going to shoot it," he told them. "I'll show you how good the migra is with our pistolas." He hopped out of the truck and squeezed off a shot with his pistol. "Chingao, he's shooting." They flinched, ducked. He holstered his weapon and got in the truck. "Got him," he said. "Let's go see." He drove. They thought it was 50 yards, maybe. But he drove past that. And then he drove a mile. They were muttering and whistling. Then another mile. Then another damn mile. He pulled up to the saguaro cluster where he'd stashed the carcass, parked again, jumped out, and dug the rabbit out of the bushes. He held it up so they could see it. They cried out in shock and awe. "I told you the migra were good shots," he told them. The guys at the station laughed for years about that one. Drags are created by bundles of 5 car tires attached to a frame looking somewhat like the Olympic rings. Every few days, a truck chains a drag to its back end and drives the roads, ironing the sand into a smooth surface. The drags tend to cut east-west. Since the illegals head north, they are forced sooner or later to cross a drag. Devil's Highway itself is the mother of all drags. The fiendish ploys of the coyotes offer you many opportunities to hone your sign-cutting skills. The whole game for their team is to pass by invisibly, and the team on this side is paid to see the invisible. The coyotes score when they make it, and the migra scores when they don't. Like pro wrestling, there is a masked invader who regularly storms the field to disrupt the game. This, of course, is La Muerte. The illegals try to leap across the drags, but the drags are often wide enough to make jumpers hit the ground at least once. They walk backward, hoping to confuse cutters. You have to be good to confuse a veteran. An Indian reservation cop says, "Them trackers can probably tell you what color the guy's hair was and that he had 89 cents in his left pocket. Then they can tell you the last time he got laid." Lately, foamers have been walking the desert. Foamers tape blocks of foam rubber to their feet, thus leaving no prints, or so they think. Foam blocks make small right-angled dents in the soil at their corners, and sooner or later the heel of the walker will wear through the foam, and the cutter can see a weird pattern like a small half-moon hoof in a picture frame. Your classic foamer sign. Every coyote team relies on the old Apache trick of the brush out. Last man through walks backward, brushing the tracks away with a branch of some bush. It's such a standard move that Border Patrol agents call giving civilians and media types evasive answers a brush out. The Washington, D.C. desk jockeys are considered the ultimate brush out masters. There is room in this desert world for scholarship as well as sport. Cutters read the land like a text. They search the manuscript of the ground for irregularities in its narration. They know the plots and the images by heart. They can see where the punctuation goes. They are landscape grammarians, got the PhD in reading dirt. On lava, a displaced stone will reveal a semicircle of lighter ground underneath. Likewise, a pebble kicked out of place on the hardpan, where the desert varnish that accumulates on the ground reveals a crescent of paler sand. In-ground sensors are buried in places known only to the Border Patrol. These sensors are known as Oscars. A coyote would give his teeth to get hold of this information. Sometimes the sensors are very cleverly placed. Their little antennas stick up in the middle of creosote bushes. Cutters know that saguaros, the signature big cactus of the region, always grow among sheltering shrubs. So a stately old saguaro will not only serve as a signpost for the walkers, but a landmark for the cutters. And the landmark has a scribble of handy bushes around it to hide the wire. When the truck goes by on the drag, the Oscar sends a message to base. Base radios, Oscar 21, Oscar 21. The cutter answers, and he's cleared. If base doesn't clear him at his Oscar, he'll call home. Base, did you catch an Oscar just now? Oscar 25 follows Oscar 21. Oscar 35 follows Oscar 25. If a cutter vanishes between Oscar 25 and Oscar 35, they know something might be wrong. they go to look for him. If an Oscar bleeps and no cutter is nearby, they know somebody done snuck into the country. Often the drag will have what Kenny Smith calls hither-thither. Hither-thither is a scrabble of pebbles and twigs and dirt on the clean face of the drag. It's knocked from the tiny berms that the tire drags raise on either side of the road. And they tell you that someone tried to hop over. You look out beyond hither-thither for true sign. Sign cutters know most walkers pass between 11 at night and 3 the next morning. They can tell how old a track is by its sharpness. Even in the desert, dirt holds some humidity, and it is this humidity that defines the track's edges. As a track ages, it dries, and as it dries, its edges soften. Bug sign is created when small creatures begin to scurry about just before dawn. Often, this hour is the only comfortable moment of the day, and in a burst of breakfast exuberance, lizards, rats, and insects set off in a willy-nilly marathon. If bug sign crosses over a walker's footprint, the cutter knows the walker has passed nearer to midnight than to dawn. If, however, the footstep flattens the bug sign, the cutter knows the walker has recently passed and is in the immediate area and is probably in trouble. The sun is up, the temperature is rising, and the day will only get more brutal. When the cutter sees crisscrossing sign on the drag, he radios another unit. That agent drives to the next drag north and cuts. If he finds sign, he calls the first unit to leapfrog north to the next drag. He cuts it. Sooner or later, the sign runs out, and they have the walkers boxed in between them. It's when the walkers get far off the drags that all the trouble starts. Mike F.'s walkers were not only off the drag, they were off the map. Kenny Smith was working the trailer trash radio, sending more and more units on the Banzai Run. Everybody was heading out there, every truck that could move. They were even thinking of sending out the water buffaloes, the big water tank trucks in the fleet. It was a mad scramble as they raced the heat. From Vidrios Drag, the sign cutters started back into the wasteland cutting. They started finding corpses. They read the ground and found, after an amazingly long haul, where the journey had all gone so wrong. Some of the illegals had walked over 65 miles. A couple of them fell in sight of the freeway. All you can do, Kenny Smith said, is cut sign, cut sign, cut sign. The sign tells the story. The sign never lies. And the whole investigation became a series of drag cuts. It started after they had found all the dead, 14 men, after they had saved the rest, 12 more. The footprints wrote the story, and after the footprints ran out, it was a trail of whispered stories and paper sheets. It was the big die-off, the largest death event in border history. Everybody wanted to know what happened, how it happened. The old boys of Welton were forever changed by it. The media started calling the dead the Yuma 14. National stories focused on the Devil's Highway as a great metaphor for the horrors of the trail. But the agents who saw it all simply referred to it as what happened. As in, what happened in May, or what happened in the desert. Nothing fancy. Somebody had to follow the tracks. They told the story. They went down into Mexico, back in time and ahead, into paupers' graves. Before the Yuma 14, there were the smugglers. Before the smugglers, there was the Border Patrol. Before the Border Patrol, there was the border conflict. Before them all was desolation itself. These are the things they carried. John Doe number 36. Red underpants. Mesquite beans stuck to his skin. John Doe number 37. No effects. John Doe number 38. Green socks. John Doe number 39. A belt buckle with a fighting cock inlaid. One wallet in the right front pocket of his jeans. John Doe number 40. No effects. John Doe number 41. Fake silver watch, 6 Mexican coins, 1 comb, a belt buckle with a spur inlaid, 4 pills in a foil strip, possibly Advil or allergy gel caps. John Doe number 42. Furor jeans. Had a colored piece of paper in pocket. John Doe number 43, green handkerchief, pocket mirror in right front pocket. John Doe number 44, Mexican bills in back pocket, a letter in right front pocket, a brown wallet in left front pocket. John Doe number 45, no record. John Doe number 46, no record. John Doe number 47, no effects. One tattoo, Maria. John Doe number 48, Converse knockoff basketball shoes. John Doe number 49, a photo ID of some sort, apparently illegible. They came to the broken place of the world, and taken all together, they did not have enough items to fill a carry-on bag. Welton's officer friendly, a Latino who looks Italian, bristles at calling them the Yuma 14. If anything, they're the Welton 14, he says. We found 'em. Yuma didn't do shit. In Tucson, however, they're considered to be the Tucson 14. The confusion comes easy. The group entered the United States in Tucson sector, and they were headed for a Tucson sector pickup spot. They just happened to have died in the Yuma sector by accident. Walkers are identified by sector, not station, so the Welton crew was erased from the headlines. Thus, Yuma was forever enshrined as the rescuer of the survivors and the collectors of the dead. There were other claims, too. Coming into the game a little late, Mexico declared the Yuma 14 as folk heroes. After all, Mexico loves a martyr, perhaps as much as it dislikes confronting the catastrophic political malfeasance that forced the walkers to flee their homes and bake to death in the western desert. Human rights activists claimed them, too. Our 14 murdered brothers. Journalists took them as the hottest story, no pun intended, in many years. Officer Friendly considered all this a steaming pile of Bravo Sierra. They were not only Welton's bodies, he points out, but there were 26 of them, not 14. They're the Welton 26, he says. All of them are victims, even the live ones, and they're mine. Nobody wanted them when they were alive. And now look, everybody wants to own them. Their paperwork got processed through Tucson as well. The dead were given back to Mexico's care through the auspices of the consul's offices in the borderland. The consul of Calexico flew home with the bodies, their first and last trip by airplane. And Tucson's consul, Carlos Flores Vizcarra, collected the files. The death reports went to the groaning shells of the Tucson consulate. It was all quite routine, with regular patterns, ruts, and observances. When a fresh death report comes into the consulate building. The women of the consulate light votive candles. Each desk flickers with a small flame. If you didn't know any better, you would think it was a religious observance. The reports arrive from the officials, so many that it's getting hard to file them. Shelves are stuffed with them, and piles of reports sometimes accumulate on the tabletops. The Yuma 14's documents, like all of the death reports at the consulate, were tucked into accordion folders, cheap manila packets available in any Target or Kmart. The death packets are known as archives, and harvest season, May through July, is known as death season. It is then that lettuce, tomatoes, cucumbers, oranges, strawberries are all ready to be picked. Arkansas chickens are ready to be plucked. Cows are waiting in Iowa and Nebraska to be ground into hamburger, and grills are ready in McDonald's and Burger King and Wendy's and Taco Bell for the ground meat to be cooked. KFC is waiting for its Mexican slaughtered chickens to be fried by Mexicans. And the Western Desert is waiting too, its temperature soaring, a fryer in its own right. OTM, other than Mexicans, covers all the Central and South Americans swelling the ranks of the walkers. Many Americans don't know that Chinese and Russian refugees cross desolation as well. And Mexican smugglers are now using freighters to run the North American coastline and drop the walkers into Canada, where the rules are lax, and the border, twice the length of the Mexican border, is even more abandoned. Middle Eastern operatives look like Mexicans. As long as they keep their mouths shut, they can pass. Muslim missionaries have moved into southern Mexico, often taking up where Christian evangelists have left off. They set up Quranic schools in Indian villages and in tribes where the children do not even speak Spanish. They are being taught to read, speak, and write Arabic. Reportedly, the largest Al-Qaeda training ground in the New World is in Brazil. The Texas and Arizona branches of the Border Patrol have aired suspicions that the smugglers are happy to transport Al-Qaeda members across the Devil's Highway. In a world of pure capitalism, Osama's crew has the juice. These ultimate OTMs are said to pay $50,000 apiece. Of course, the illegals have always been called names other than human. Wetback, taco bender. A Mexican worker said, "If I am a wetback because I crossed a river to get here, what are you, who crossed an entire ocean?" In politically correct times, illegal alien was deemed gauche, so undocumented worker came into favor. Now, however, the term preferred by the Arizona press is undocumented entrant, as if the United States were a militarized beauty pageant. Maybe it is. In the strange military poetics of the Border Patrol, the big kill itself is known not only as the case of the Yuma 14, it is officially called Operation Broken Promise. Of all the catchphrases of the event, this is perhaps the most accurate. In the postmortem packets, you will find death certificates, coroner's reports, INS or sheriff's reports, and the pictures. Each report has color photographs of the dead, both in hard copy printouts and digitized on computer disks. The pictures focus on the faces, or what's left of the faces, then the torsos, occasionally the genitalia. Hands are greatly in evidence, but you never see feet. The dead have open mouths and white teeth. They are stretched in angular poses, caught in last gasps or shouts, their eyes burned an eerie red by the sun. Many of them are naked. Some of them have dirt in their mouths. When the corpses are those of women, their breasts have shrunk and withered and cracked open under the sun. The dead's open mouths reveal gums that have turned to some substance that looks like baked adobe, crumbling and almost orange. They look like roadside attractions, like wax and paper torsos in a gas station dungeon of terror. For many of them, these are the first portraits for which they have posed. The Yuma 14 are all male. Along with dead flesh, the photographs show pants, shoes, underwear, teeth in close-up, tattoos, if any. The pants are Latino knockoffs of American designer jeans, Furor, OK Roy, Fase 2000. Most of the underpants are colored as if the walkers hoped to be styling when they got to Phoenix. Blue, red, and black are the favored colors. The underpants are stained, either with urine or other body liquids that have boiled out of the corpses. Among the paperwork and photographs in each packet is a king-size Ziploc sandwich bag. Each baggie contains the final effects of the walkers, whatever was found on and around the bodies that might be returned to their survivors or that might be used to identify the dead. Some reports wittily call these men Juan Does. Jane Doe becomes Juana Doe. The women of the consulate open the files and catalog what remains. If you are lucky, they will show you these treasures. As they search for the Yuma 14's archives, they place a fresh folder on the table. It contains a wallet, a few coins, a comb with hair and dandruff in its teeth, and a Catholic scapular. The picture on the scapular is of the Virgin of Guadalupe. The stench sneaks from the baggie. The women tell you that they go home with the smell on their skin, in their hair and clothing. Sometimes when several packets have arrived in their office, they can't wash it off, even hours later. A year after death, files still reek faintly of spoiled flesh. The incense of their death takes over the room. So the women light candles. Once their candles are lit, they bend to the task of trying to find the families back in Mexico so they can deliver their grim news. Many dead walkers come from places with no phones, homes with no addresses. The best the consulate can do is call the village phone booth and hope a passerby will answer. Or they track down the mayor of the nearest town, and he then either does or does not find the widows. In the back office of the consulate, the chemical scent of jasmine, musk, vanilla fights the smell of corruption. One of the secretaries utters the Mexican phrase for yuck, guacala. It sounds like something you eat. The chief of consular security waves her off. He says, when forensic evidence fails us, we are forced to register circumstantial evidence. Forensic evidence would consist of such things as fingerprints. But the nature of desert death is such that forensic evidence is quickly obliterated. The body mummifies. In one of the million ironies of the desert, those who die of thirst become waterproof. Their fingers turn to stiff leather, and the prints are unreadable. On the day the consulate reopens the files of the Yuma 14, they have four bodies undergoing hydration at the coroner's lab. A new corpse, Juan Doe, number 78, is cooling in their company. The coroners pump fluids into their reluctant tissue, sometimes for days, to try to plump up the desiccated skin enough to raise a usable print. The chief's excited. This CSI stuff is fun. Your boys he enthuses. We're only out there 3 days or so. They're already turning to mummies, but they're not so bad. You ought to see the ones who've been out there a week, 2 weeks, black as leather, and they crack open. Red and brown stuff drips out all over the ground. He pulls a face. It's a soup. It's disgusting. Many of the dead have gold or gold-rimmed or missing teeth, and their photographs offer the final indignity. They have white rubber-clad fingers jammed in their mouths, pulling their lips apart in maniacal grimaces to reveal these orthodontic details. For these few, it has to be the teeth. There is literally nothing else. The bodies that are identified are ultimately processed by the Adair Funeral Home in Tucson. They are embalmed, then placed in a cloth-covered wooden casket. This undertaking costs $650. If they are to be flown home, the air tray to hold the casket costs an extra $50. The Mexican consulates pay for the embalming, and other parties, sometimes the governments of the walkers' home states, pay for the flights. For more than 80% of the dead, it is the most expensive gift they have ever gotten. Those who are never identified are registered by the United States. Under their new government-bestowed number, they are interred in the Potter's Field at the Fort Lowell Cemetery in Tucson. They each get a small marker with metal serial numbers. These Juan Doe burials cost Pima County $760 each. What of others? What of the phantom walkers from the Welton 26? Stories float among the survivors that three men walked away. Some call it the Welton 30. One survivor still maintains there were 70 in the original group. They are gone, the Mexican consul in Tucson says. No, no. He looks out the window. You will never find them. He rests his hands on the desk and looks at them. Perhaps a scrap of clothing. He sighs. In the desert, Levi's last longer than meat. 6 coins and 4 pills. A green handkerchief. The candles flicker. Some of the Yuma 14, Welton 26, spoke Spanish as a second language. It surprises people to learn that many of the undocumented entrants are indigenous. Think of the border struggle as an extension of the Indian Wars, the cavalry now chasing new Apaches and Comanches. Much of the human hunting that goes on along the border happens on Cocopa, Papago, Pima, Apache, and Yaqui lands. The Arizona Border Patrol, with millions of acres to inspect, has struck up an uncomfortable relationship with the natives in its path. Tohono O'odham people, for example, regularly submit complaints of harassment by Tucson sector. A truckload of Indians looks like a truckload of Mexicans to the cavalry. The Mexican mestizos south of the border, who traditionally lack our nostalgia for the Indian past, call the walkers Oaxacas, from the name of the Mexican state that houses one of the largest Indian populations. Oaxaca is a code name for Indian, usually Mixtec. The women are often ridiculed as the Marias. Some of the Tohono O'odham call the walkers invading their res Oaxacas. The Yuma 14 are still regularly called the Oaxacas, Indians, calling Indians, Indians. The majority of the group came from tropical Veracruz. No terrorists, ex-cons, or drug mules. Mostly small plot farmers, coffee growers, a schoolboy and his dad, Some of them were used to seeing up to 60 inches of rain a year. The Devil's Highway would be lucky to get 60 inches in a decade. They walked into the desert carrying soft drinks. Most of them had never seen a desert. Several of them had never ridden on a train, an elevator, or an escalator. Some had never driven a car. Some of them had never eaten flour tortillas. To them, that was exotic food. There are two fairly common jokes told about America among undocumented entrants. A, don't drink the water. And B, for good American food, go to Taco Bell. What we take for granted in the United States as being Mexican, to those from southern Mexico, is almost completely foreign. Rural Mexicans don't have the spare money to drown their food in melted cheese. They don't smother their food in mounds of sour cream. Who would pay for it? They have never seen nachos. In some regions of the South, they eat soup with bananas. Some tribal folks not far from Veracruz eat termite tacos. Turkey, when there are turkeys, is not filled with stuffing, but with dried pineapples, papaya, pecans. Meat is killed behind the house, or it is bought dripping and fly-blown off a wooden plank in the village market. They eat cheeks, ears, feet, tails, lips, fried blood, intestines filled with curdled milk. Southerners grew up eating corn tortillas, and they never varied in their diet. You find them eating food the Aztecs once ate. Flour tortillas? Burritos? Chimichangas? It's foreign food to them, invented on the border. They were aliens before they ever crossed the line. Part 2. Dead Man's Sign. Chapter 2. In Veracruz. The state of Veracruz lies in the southeast of Mexico, its southwestern end anchoring it to the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, the narrowest portion of the country, a slim land bridge that is echoed to the far south by Panama. The steamy waters of the Gulf of Mexico eddy off the beaches of Veracruz, and the air of the tropics is caught here between the mountains and the sea, the green peaks wear scarves of fog. Its immediate neighbors to the south are Tabasco and the troubled state of Chiapas. Mexico City lies to the west. Guatemala is less than 500 miles away. Veracruz is a name bequeathed to the region by the conquest. It means the true cross. But its native roots run deeper, and more ancient names still grace the towns and villages of the region. Coscomatepec, Chicontepec, Tlacotepec, Jototepec, Atzalan. Indigenous ghosts haunt the land. The affix Tepec reveals much about the landscape. Tepec in Nahuatl means hill. Although it is a coastal state, Veracruz is ringed by mountains. To the north, the Sierra Madre Oriental begins. To the west rises the massive volcanic range and plateau that encircles Mexico City. And to the south, which due to the bend in the geographic elbow of the isthmus, is Mexico's west coast, is the Sierra Madre del Sur. In Veracruz, things weren't going well. The people were killing themselves, working the ranchos on the outskirts. The fishermen couldn't catch enough protein in the sea. The cane cutters couldn't cut enough cane. The small peasant farmers couldn't get good enough prices to cover the costs of planting and harvesting their coffee. Even the marijuana growers were making meager wages once the narcos took their hit off the top, and the cops got their mordidas, bribes. But it was mostly the collapse of the coffee prices. Locals will tell you that even 10 years ago, the surge of illegal immigration to the north hadn't affected them. Rather than going away, they were willing to stick it out, and various waves of semi-prosperity affected the region. Coca-Cola and Pepsi hired workers. The fisheries and growing tourist markets took them to the coast, and the region was fertile. Crops were variously in favor. In fact, the only illegal immigration that greatly affected Veracruz back then was the unwanted horde of aliens coming north to sample the good life in Mexico. Illegals from Guatemala and Salvador were taking all the low-paying jobs in the cities. Panamanians were making tacos and fireworks. Nicaraguans and Colombians were sweeping streets and cleaning toilets. Hondurans in the schools. Prices kept rising, and all families, mestizos and Indian, Mexican and illegal, Protestant, Catholic, or heathen, were able to afford less and less. Food was harder to come by. Forget about telephones, clothes, cars, furniture. Even chicken feed, being maíz, was expensive. Pampers, milk, baby formula, shoes, tuition, tools, medicine. Families continued to grow. The gringos and the missionaries and even the government representatives from Mexico City told them to stop procreating. It was simple. Too many mouths caused hunger. But the Pope ordered them to continue being fertile. Even condoms were wicked. And in the economy of hunger, which the fat men of the governments did not understand, more mouths meant more chances to survive. With a high rate of infant and childhood mortality, the lower castes, the workers, and the tribal people of the Third World tended to rely on their own procreative gifts for survival. If one out of five died, that still left four to grow up and begin to work. When madre y padre became old, ill, infirm, it was only the family that would protect them. No AARP or Medicare in the jungle. Four children with children of their own might suddenly represent a small army of 20, all working, all pitching in, all offering a tithe of food or money or water or tequila. True communism. On a family level, you'd think that at least there would be beans to eat, but the great Mexican bean-growing industrial farms sold much of their crop to the United States. It was easier for a Sinaloa farm to get the beans to California than to Veracruz, and more lucrative. These beans were poured into folkloric Mexican-looking burlap bags, shipped to Los Angeles, then resold to Mexican distributors. Worn burlap sacks with their colorful portraits of Mexicans and donkeys and Aztecs were eventually recycled into useful fabrics in the tropical homes of Veracruz. Bean sack curtains for homes that could no longer afford beans. Between Americanized prices for their frijoles and the unpredictable spikes in the price of tortillas, the Veracruzanos sometimes didn't even know how they would feed their families. It wasn't just Veracruz. Mexico itself was spending 80 cents from every earned dollar on foreign debt. The vast money machine that was Pemex gasoline and oil bled more pesos than it put into the national economy. The even bigger narco money never made it out of clandestine mansions. It was a two-way flow. Western Union had facilitated a cash flood back from Chicago and Los Angeles. Remittance money stormed south from East Harlem and San Francisco, Seattle, and Skokie. It cost $15 a pop to transfer funds to the terminals at Banamex. Western Union became so much a part of the folklore that it had its own nickname, La Western. People without electricity were well-versed in using its computerized services. Bright high school kids from the dirt and thatch villas in the hills could make their way to the city and call up JustinTimberlake.com at the internet cafe. If they didn't go north before, they were not going to let the American millennium pass them by this time around. Men came home from the United States in cars. Some even had the latest models, new Dodge Ram trucks, bright red, booming Eminem on their CD players. Business-minded fellows could load up at a Texas Goodwill and sell the stuff for twice the price back home. They had their trunks and back seats full of old TVs, radios, clothes, toys. Even guys driving rust-bomb old Datsuns had stuffed them with Care Bears and Walkman, skateboards, and bags of panties. People would spend months' worth of savings on a small used television or Christmas bike, selling for cheaper than the new stuff in the unapproachable Mexican department stores. These fellows offered handshake financing, too. They were, after all, cousins and neighbors and uncles and boyfriends. They kept elaborate accounts in their heads, paid off a few pesos or a meal at a time. When the drivers had sold all their wares, they put the old cars on the market, too. Cast-off and donated clothing could be sold in the Segunda, a rolling flea market set up at each wanderer's house. Some hard workers picked trash at the border's garbage dumps, fixed the cast-offs, and resold them at the Segundas back home. It was a rural black market. They built cement block additions to their tumble-down houses, added aluminum to the thatch roofs. New clothes were signs of great success. Satellite dishes, air conditioners, boom boxes, guns, cattle, televisions, coffee makers, PCs, pigs. Some even got telephones. It was unheard of. Villages all over Mexico were suddenly slotting in to the internet, watching CNN. Families came back with babies who were supposedly American citizens. The neighbors of these adventure capitalists watched and wanted. Their children were dying. Dengue fever had made its way up from the Amazon. Malaria was spreading again, and it was worse than before. This new black blood malaria. Corruption, political violence, indigenous revolution in the south. People in Veracruz were looking north, as inevitably as the rains came and the mosquitoes bit. Enter Don Moy, recruiter for the Northern Coyotes. Don Moy Garcia drove around Veracruz in his big American car, smoking his American cigarettes, patting his Mexican belly that everyone suspected was full of American cheeseburgers. Don Moy was a walking ad for the good life. Don Moy was trustworthy. The gold watch and the prefix Don or Sir, even Sire, took care of that. But he was also a local, living in Tlapacoyan. People knew him. They'd seen him for years doing his business. He was the godfather of kids, the compadre of their parents, a tío, one of the uncles, a neighbor. He was gray-haired, a man, as they said, of substance. They didn't want to say he was fat, but he had a great, solid belly. People could tell the old man was enjoying a comfortable life. That panza of his got him plenty of business. Hungry men wanted guts like his. Uncle Moy. He drove into the highlands, cutting through jungle and terraced, jewel-bright farmland. He had an exotic cell phone, and he murmured into it, talking to mysterious people in El Norte. He made himself available at restaurants, in cantinas. He could be found wherever men gathered for a cup of coffee, with raw cane syrup and goat milk in each cup. Don Moy was a fixer for the shadowy coyotes of Sonora, a Robin Hood figure to the muchachos of Veracruz, a benevolent outlaw with a bushy mustache. And like all gangsters, he had accumulated a certain place of honor. Many of the poor mothers and fathers who called him Don were older than he. Almost nobody called him by his birth name, Moises. Like royalty, he had taken on a title. In North America, the myth tends west. The cowboys, the Indians, the frontier, the wildlands, the bears and wolves and gold mines and vast ranches were in the west. But in Mexico, a country narrow at bottom and wide at the top, the myth ran north. The Mayas pushed north, and the Aztecs pushed north once they'd formed an empire. Later, the Spaniards pushed north. The wide open spaces lay northward. The cowboys and Indians, the great Pancho Villa outlaws, the frontier lay north, not west. That's why Norteño people are the cowboys of Mexico, not Westerners. The Spanish word for border is, after all, frontera, the frontier. Along with great adventures in the West, Americans yearned for riches. The gold rush and the land rush come to mind. For the Mexicans, the gold rush lay in those mystical lands up there, above Orange County, Cicero, Dubuque, Odessa. More than 4,000 men from the region had already left. New explorers prepared. They approached Don Moy in small groups. Some of them didn't know each other. He met the Bautistas in Equimite, near their home, the first of the Welton 26. Heading for a place they'd never heard of, had never imagined, Arizona. The joke was to call it Narizona, or the woman with a big nose. Don Moy greeted them and invited them to a sit-down. Yes. He listened and nodded. His rings defined arcs of gold in the air as he stirred his coffee. Oh, yes, boys, sure. Things can be arranged, but they're complicated. You see, it's expensive. Expensive? What I do isn't missionary work, boys. It's a business. I'm a professional. But of course, claro. Who would suggest otherwise, Don Moy? My services are the best, so I charge for them. The ring, the neck chain, the watch. He sipped his coffee. His belly challenged the buttons on his guayabera. How expensive. The Bautista boys weren't cheap, but they weren't rich either. The idea was to go make money, not lose it all before they'd gotten going. Well, how much is your future worth to you? Well, chingao, we don't have much. It's 16,000 pesos to cross into the U.S., and it's 3,000 more for your bus trip and food and lodging to get to the border. Let's say 20,000 pesos each. Low whistles. 20,000 pesos. It takes us a year to make 20,000 pesos. Don Moy could sense their reservations, but he'd gotten the bite. Now he had to set the hook. He beamed at them. But you won't have to go alone. I'll go with you. Don Moy, the great father, leading his boys on a field trip. You will? We'll go together. Do you think I'd let my clients wander to El Norte alone? Laughter. Hooks it. Of course, you can save some money if you're men enough to walk in the desert instead of catching a ride or sneaking into a city. Man enough. I'm nothing but man, Don Moy. How much will you take off the top if we walk? I can get you there for 13,000 if you walk.